This is the Love Foco Show.
I took a day off of work and I took the MAX bus to downtown for my daughter's birthday. And I run into a client and I'm like, ugh, my day off of work, no. But he has grocery bags on his feet and he just got a haircut. And when he heard it was my daughter's birthday, he reached into his bag and he got out a roll of Sacagawea gold coins. And he dug his thumb in and he peeled off a coin to give to my daughter. And people, even in the lowest parts of our society, could become somebody who can go around the community and give out gold coins.
Welcome to the Love Foco Show. Our podcast highlights the incredible people who make Fort Collins the place we're proud to call home. Each week, your host, Jeff Faust, sits down with local leaders, community champions, and change makers to share their stories, what they love about our city, and how they're helping it thrive. So whether you're out on the trail, at a brewery, or walking through Old Town, thanks for tuning in.
Hey everyone, Jeff Faust here, your host for the Love Foco Show. I'm so excited to share this conversation with you. Today I'm sitting down with Seth Forwood, the director of the Denver Rescue Mission up here in Fort Collins. He has an incredible story, one marked with, you know, faithfulness, but also a mixture of tragedy and just growth and continued progress, both in his own life as well as in his service to the community around us. And bonus, there are some really exciting things that he is leading in our city to bless and care for so many individuals that call our city their home. You're not going to want to miss this conversation, and I'm so thankful that Seth sat down with us for a conversation today. Well, Seth, thank you so much for making time for the Love Foco Show. Grateful that you're here with us. And man, I've been looking forward to this conversation because the work that you're doing in our city is, it's so needed, so impactful. And I know it will just touch a lot of people's lives directly and indirectly. And so thanks for making time to sit down with me.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. It's good to be here with you.
We like to start these conversations the same way. We all have a different story. We all have different things that brought us to Fort Collins and Northern Colorado area. And of course, all of our lives are kind of being weaved together in some kind of interesting way. And so would love to just hear from you, like, what is your Fort Collins origin story? You know, how'd you get here? Where'd you come from? What are some of those things that shaped you even to be into the place that you find yourself today?
Yeah. So, I'm not a native, not technically a native for those that are sticklers about
there's
that.
There's not a lot. That's what I'm learning. There's not truly a lot.
It's true. So I was born in Manhattan, Kansas.
Okay. Is that Wildcat territory, like K-State?
Yes, okay. I believe so. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, Ag University.
Yep.
Moved to Columbia, Missouri. Okay. Another Ag University.
Yeah.
And then moved to Fort Collins in 89.
Okay.
To CSU, another Ag University.
Wait, so how old were you when you moved here?
I was right around 8 or 9 years old.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so you had a couple of moves early. I mean, like, do you remember Manhattan at all?
No.
Okay.
No.
What about Columbia?
Yeah, I remember Columbia.
You remember
a lot.
Columbia?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because we had this gorgeous property with sheep and a hill and a lake, you know, all that kind of stuff. My dad was an agricultural researcher for the federal government. Okay. And got a job here in connection with CSU, but not for CSU. It was still for the federal government. We moved out here when I was 8 or 9. Yeah. And a little bit after moving here, my dad died of a severe heart attack that no one saw coming. Just one Saturday morning, it was like he was gone. So there's some grace, actually, in being in Fort Collins and not in Missouri, where we had all this property, and my mom would have had to, you know, figure out what to do with all of that. Yeah. So even though that was tragic and it's been very definitive in my life, losing my dad so early.
How old were you again?
I was 10 when he died. Yeah. And he was 41 years old.
Yeah, but like I have a 10-year-old.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, that's kind of surreal.
Yeah.
Just brings it home to a personal level on my end. But
turning 41 a couple of years ago was quite a trip.
Yeah.
You know, with that experience with my dad. But we stayed here, you know, after that. And I went to CSU, you know, so I grew up here and I pretty much stayed here ever since.
Okay.
You know, about 33, 34 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's how I grew up here.
Well, let me ask you just a couple of questions.
And
you can pass on as many of these questions as you want to pass on.
Okay.
But I find myself just kind of curious. As a 10-year-old, I mean, was what began to kind of fill some of the aches of your heart, or mm-hmm. even maybe even some of the gaps of like, man, I had a dad for these really formative years and now my dad's passed. I'm 11, I'm 12, I'm 13. I'm going to go through a growth spurt at some point.
Sure.
How did you find yourself just even like emotionally navigating some of those spaces? Is it okay for me to ask that?
Yeah, sure it is. And I have a lot of answers to it. A real quick one is I didn't handle my dad's death well at all. I started to get migraines and I would like pull on my hair. I just couldn't absorb it in any kind of healthy way. And so I really like numbed out on it for a long time. And so I can go back and tell you about how that got resolved early in adulthood. But so that was one factor.
And that's just like the stress and the pain coming out in like really tangible,
like
physical ways.
Yeah. That I
because
just
our bodies are connected to our minds, are
right.
connected to our, and so
yep.
it seems like it was just being expressed as a 10 or 11 year old in ways that maybe you couldn't articulate.
Yeah. Yeah. I just couldn't understand it, you know, and I couldn't handle it. So I kind of just locked it away.
Yeah.
But we were part of a church locally here. And I did have several really great father figures. You know, the friends, my friend's dad, who was friends with my dad, was a really important, you know, guy in my life. Yeah. And then also a part of that church, we were part of a small group, you know? So my parents would bounce around to other families' houses for like their weekly Bible studies. Okay.
And this is like one of those things where the kids tag along
that's
and
right.
like eat a meal together and hang
like,
out
yeah,
and
run
live
feral
life together.
In the streets,
yes.
you know,
yeah, yeah.
or, you know, in not so great times, ding dong ditch, you
yes.
know, other neighboring
yeah.
houses
yep.
during Bible study.
Well, I'm 40 years old and I ding dong ditched the other day and left my wife on something which was hilarious because she didn't see it coming. So you're never too old. You're never too old for that.
Another family in that group of small group collection of families, there was a lady who had cancer on and off for a long, long time. And she shared after a really bad prognosis that it was basically terminal now. And they really tried everything that they could. And she wasn't afraid of dying at all. But she expressed to the small group, like, I'm afraid of being alone because nobody wants to be around somebody who's actively dying, you know, where cancer is like taking from them until they lose their life. And my mom was a nurse and she worked at PVH. She was a NICU nurse. And so she worked a lot with infants, but she was super comfortable in
yeah.
that
She'd
environment.
Been around pain and tragic, anxious moments.
Yeah. And so she said, you know what, let's just schedule a standing, you know, date where we can hang out on like Tuesday afternoons or Tuesday mornings, whatever it was. Because I would be thrilled to be with you as you go on this journey and we can just be together. And on one of those times, this lady and my mom were out to breakfast, and this lady looks at my mom and she says, "Rosemary, I really think I found a good match for you," because this was after my dad died. And she said, "I think my husband would be a good match for you after I'm dead."
Whoa.
And my mom just kind of, I don't know how you gracefully respond to that kind of statement.
I mean, I'm sitting here and I did not expect that turn in the conversation.
I know. And so I think she just said, "Wow. Wow." But Linda did end up dying shortly after that. And this was probably over a year after my dad had died. And then, you know, maybe 8 months, 9 months after this lady had died. And my mom ended up dating this lady's husband.
Really?
And ended up marrying him.
Stop.
And so I had a stepdad.
Yeah.
And he wasn't my dad, you know? But yep. he just died in April. And he was my dad longer than my biological father was.
Yeah.
And he was such a kind, gracious guy. He was a local family physician here, so he was part of healing many people. He even helped my wife because she went to his practice before we got married. You know, she was a little child, and so he was also a huge gift from God in my life, not having my father, but having an amazing stepdad that I called my dad for the majority of my life. And that was just, he was such a, you realize how much you need these people and how much you miss them and how much you depend on them once they're gone.
Yeah.
But I'm so grateful for the 30 years that I had him as my dad.
Well, and it's really interesting. I mean, thank you for sharing that. Mm-hmm. That's an incredible story to hear and to share with our listeners. That one of the things that really, I mean, there's a lot of things I would love to talk about around that, but one of the things I hear in that story is like really maybe what I would call social or like relational economy.
Yeah.
For lack of better words. Like when your mom was grieving and your family was grieving, this community centered around faith.
Yeah.
In this faith community really circled around you, and then your mom who experienced that comfort was able to offer that comfort to someone else who's grieving.
Yeah, that's right.
And then even after another person passed, mm-hmm. that this kind of relational network and community that then even merged together and became one family unit.
Yeah.
That is so important.
Yeah.
I mean, we're going to hopefully, we are going to very soon talk about your work with Denver Rescue Mission. I'm very excited for that conversation. But anybody who's worked in this space or anybody who's worked in like the human space, human services, we all know financial things are important.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a bunch of other economies that are important in someone's life to help them thrive.
Yeah.
Emotional health, financial health, of course, but also this relational and social support system is so important, and it feels providential that you are surrounded with older men and different community members that could keep pouring into you in your formative years.
Well, and it's you will find it no more precious to have that network of support and you know, mutual giving and receiving. It becomes precious when you hit suffering, you know, when you encounter suffering, like death, like unexpected disease, or, you know, a medical emergency.
Yeah.
You know, that is when something that you take for granted all the time. I know I take it for granted all the time. But that's when you really realize that it is what forges grace out of suffering in life. And that's
but
really
that's
what happens.
That's not natural for everyone. I mean, because you've probably been around enough people who've experienced suffering, have gone in a different direction than where your life has gone. I mean, I've seen people respond to suffering in a lot of different ways. What do you think allowed you to respond in the midst of that suffering in a positive way. I mean, you go back to your 10-year-old self, you fast forward to, I mean, you're probably in your 40s at this point. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there are ups and downs and false starts and retreats, sure, all kinds of things, but the knowing enough of you, your heart has stayed alive, and you still have this desire to give back to the community. I mean, how did you, what do you think allowed you to navigate that suffering in such a grace-filled way?
Well, I mean, the community carried me for a long time, you know, just in the ways that we just described.
Yeah.
There's this fantastic poet named Christian Wiman, and he wrote a memoir called My Bright Abyss. And I'm going to tie this back to my life real soon, but I just wanted to mention it because I think everyone should read him. In his memoir, it's about his time where two things happened to him. He was a poet. He grew up West Texas, Southern Baptist, left the faith for a long time, and poetry was his religion. And he was a editor of Poetry Magazine, the biggest and oldest poetry kind of journal in the United States for a long time. So hugely accomplished there. But two things happened to him. He fell in love, like deep, true love. And he was diagnosed with a rare bone marrow cancer. Wow. Right after falling in love. And those two events are what brought him back to the Christian faith. Because one, he would sit down with his wife before his diagnosis, and they'd be so happy that they just want to give thanks to the universe, you know? They just wanted some huge target to be grateful for, because that was their experience of love. And then when he's confronted with death, he must find some meaning in life, you know? He has to have something to help him navigate this awful cancer diagnosis and the treatment. So for me also, the experience of my dad's death, and then I fell in love with my wife. And in my late 20s, and as soon as I fell in love with my wife and I'm like, oh, I want to live with this person for the rest of my life, the next thought in my mind was, oh, crap, I have some stuff I have to figure out. And all the stuff that I locked away, yep, from my dad's death, I knew was still there. And I knew that as much as I had that contained, it would contain how much joy and love and full living that I could share with this woman that I wanted to share it with. Yeah. And I knew I had to give her more than what I was capable of giving at that point. And so that's when I just started going to counseling. Yep. And I went there to, like, it wasn't premarital counseling, but it was, yep, like, I want to get married, and I can't get married like, yeah, I am right now.
Yeah.
And so that was really helpful to finally have somebody help me unpack something that I had worked really hard to lock down. And it was hard work. There were a lot of times where I just kind of stared at my counselor, yep, and tried to access these feelings of grief and loss and regret. And eventually, you know, I got there, but it was a
big tragedy.
A long process, over, yeah, a year of going to counseling. But that helped me be able to fully engage with life. There's a Buddhist writer, Jon Kabat-Zinn, I think is his name. And I love one of the phrases he has. It's called full catastrophe living. And I wasn't able to do full catastrophe living, you know, because I had contained, yeah, some pretty big things. Yeah. So that also led me into my career. You know, I went and eventually did social work because I had such a good experience with counseling, and it helped me so much. A lot of times you see that, you know, counselors are counselors because they received from counseling,
right,
in pretty pivotal times in their lives. Yeah. Yep. But yeah, so counseling and the counseling process, and really the love that I wanted to embrace but couldn't embrace, was the motivation to actually get me over the hump of the fear of encountering all this loss that was like this gaping black hole in the middle of my life.
Well, it sounds like you've done a lot of work. But man, anybody who's been through that and tried to do that work knows it's hard work.
Yeah.
It's not easy work.
Yeah.
But I can't think of a better, I mean, we'll put the show notes for that poet and maybe we'll try to find that poem and that memoir to put in the show notes as well. It sounds like an incredible little read, but even can't think of a better way to encourage young men to just do the work.
Yeah.
Because those untended to tragedies really can, they just linger on.
Yeah.
I like how you put it. They put a cap or they put a ceiling on even your ability to experience like the full human nature.
Sure. Your emotional register across the board is limited. Because of even one area of your emotional development being stunted or contained or, you know, not developed fully. Yeah. So, I would say counseling has been one of the most important things. But, you know, to kind of veer over into my professional career also, I went to a large evangelical church as a youth, you know, where my parents met and we were given pretty great gifts. But as a college student, like a lot of college students, I was super frustrated with my experience of my church.
Yeah.
As a more balanced, less reactive adult, I realized that a lot of my complaints were probably more about me than the church. But
in your 20s, you only can see it one way.
That's right.
You're 20.
That's right. And really, just to put a fine point on it, I felt like everybody who went to church put on a mask before they entered church, you know, that everything's great and okay. And we don't have any problems. Things are just doing fine. And then as soon as they get out of church, they take off the mask and they are their real selves.
Yes. And there's a lot of, I'm thinking about like the songs that are sung, the conversations that are had, a lot of them are around, and rightfully so, some of them they're around joy, they're around victory, they're around living your best life, you know, and things like that. That we haven't written as many songs about lament
and
grief. I mean, they don't sell.
Yeah.
And I, you know, anything that's good in America right now, it tends to get monetized. And like, you know, songs of lament probably aren't going to sell a lot of copies.
Yep.
It's really interesting, even that you bring up kind of an evangelical background. We just had a speaker come out and spend some time with me and my staff. And he said, you know, the problem with words is you just never know where they've been.
Yeah.
And so evangelical, even that word evangelical 60 years ago meant something very different than it means today.
Yeah, that's right.
And even the expression of that in our churches can mean something different today than it than it used to. And I think it's a common journey for a lot of young people who want to take their faith seriously, but have had one background or one particular way to really want to strengthen some of their faith experience, their understanding, even the way that our faith encourages us to engage with the world around us.
Yeah.
Sounds like there's been some of that in your journey as well.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you brought up the word evangelical because I don't want to paint with too broad of a brush. Because even the evangelical in the 90s, you know, or the 2000s that I'm talking about is not the evangelical church of today.
Right.
You know, I went to a meeting just a couple of months ago that it's called the Order of the Common Life. Have you heard of this?
Oh, yeah.
It's started by evangelical vineyard pastors who are taking the rule of Saint Benedict and the daily office prayer and saying, Let's talk about spiritual formation.
So who were you hanging out with?
This was just like an informational gathering in downtown Denver.
Okay.
With I forget the guy's name who started it, but he was there.
Jared Boyd?
That might have been it.
Maybe.
I don't remember now.
Okay. trendy yeah. looking guy with
tattoos.
Anyway,
all that stuff. Yeah. But it was great. And there's an Anglican priest who's also involved in the Order of the Common Life. And I now am in the Anglican tradition, named Roscoe, who his last name's Roscoe, who is there also. And that's how I got kind of connected to it. But anyway, I don't want to paint with too broad of a brush about evangelicalism. But suffice it to say that I was in this church as a young man. I was really disaffected and disillusioned. Thankfully, I was also getting my bachelor's degree in philosophy. I went to Front Range and got my general studies degree, transferred over to CSU and got my degree in philosophy. I was delivering for Pita Pit, which used to be on Elizabeth.
Wow.
And they stay open until like god awful hours, like 2 a.m. every night. And you're just delivering pitas to drunken high college students and getting tipped in bottle rockets and like Michelob Ultra.
Yes.
And then I'm like, I had this epiphany where I'm just about to finish up my degree in philosophy. And I'm like, what am I going to do with this? Like, I can upgrade to Pizza Hut maybe, but that's not much.
This is not the kind of job training that I had anticipated.
Well, I just don't have any career prospects whatsoever. And I didn't want to go back to school and do more philosophy. But I'm having this experience at church. I'm working at Pita Pit, and I don't have any idea what I'm going to do. I find out about, so I think I have one semester left. What am I going to do with my summer? I find an internship for a place called Harvest Farm. And I actually live on the farm with the men that are going through a long-term residential drug and alcohol treatment program.
Yep.
And I find out that this is a Christian community where the prerequisite to be a part of this community is that you have to admit that you don't have your stuff together.
Yep.
That you are broken and that you need other people to kind of hold your brokenness with you. And that's staff, that's participants in the program, like everybody who is involved with that showed me a different Christian community than what I was able to see, at least in my home church. And that, it broke me wide open as far as really finding that there was a home for me in Christianity. And it filled that gap that I really needed as a young man.
Yep.
And that was hugely important. I graduated with my philosophy degree, ended up. And a month after, I just went back there and I just said, hey, give me any job that you got. I want to work for you guys.
Yep.
And I started as like a part-time instructor.
They take philosophy majors with the Pita Pit on their resume.
It helps that I had like a 3-month interview with them, you know, just the year before. I got 2 entry-level positions. I did volunteer coordination. I taught guys how to use a computer and some finances and stuff. And that was next February, just a couple of months from now. That was 20 years ago.
Wow.
That I started working for Denver Rescue Missions, the parent organization.
Yep.
And Harvest Farm was where I started working. Harvest Farm absorbed the Open Door Rescue Mission about 12 years ago. And so that now is the Fort Collins Rescue Mission.
Yep.
And that that was the other like hugely definitive occurrence in my life that set me on a track that I'm still on right now.
Yeah. Man, it's so interesting how all of these things can intertwine. And I mean, I can just imagine, Seth, you driving around at 1 a.m. with your philosophy books and professors in your head,
listening to Tom Waits.
yes. and musing, you know, about what your life is going to be. And man, interesting thing. I don't know if Jared Boyd is the guy that you spent time with.
Yeah, that's him. That's totally him.
Down in the life of common order or the order of common life.
Yeah.
Interestingly, and I didn't know this about how our lives intertwined, but Jared Boyd was a key mentor in my life.
Oh, no way.
When I lived in Kansas City
uh-huh.
and was entering into my own discernment process about whether or not I should move to Fort Collins.
Oh, really?
And so he was a spiritual director that I was connected to, and he was in my corner, but someone not in my church, so I could process freely with and openly with, and it was such a gift.
Oh, that's great.
To be able to say, here's what I'm thinking, here's what I'm praying about, here's, you know, where I think God's leading my life. And he would ask the right questions and listen so well.
Wow.
And
that's crazy.
It was a really, really important part of my life for about a year.
Huh?
So it's just interesting to learn that about, about your journey here too.
Well, I really like what they're doing. I hope it just takes off. I think it's what the American church really needs.
I agree. And I think there's a sweetness to it. And even here, you know, your journey with Denver Rescue Mission and Harvest Farm in particular, it kind of this merging, like if we really take our faith seriously, if we believe what we read in the scriptures, then God is more interested in just whether or not we can answer a few theological questions correctly or incorrect. He's actually interested in transforming our whole self.
Mm-hmm.
And he's interested in transforming communities as well. And so I would love to take this as an opportunity to just even kind of pick your brain on a little bit about, you know, what you love about Fort Collins and how you're loving our city. Because this is ingrained in your history and who you are as a leader in our community. But you've also personally experienced it. Just with their community coming around you in the midst of tragedy, but then helping you move forward. And now you're part of that on a pretty consistent basis as well. So tell me a little bit about, you know, gosh, what do you love about our city? Why'd you stick around? And then I'd love to give you a chance to talk about Denver Rescue Mission and where you're currently at and where you're headed in the future.
Yeah, so I mean, I have kids now, and we're raising our family in Fort Collins. And one of the things that I love about Fort Collins is it's just a beautiful city.
Yeah.
You know, beauty is something that we might take for granted for in our town. And that's, you know, that's the natural areas, the parks, it's Horsetooth, it's downtown. There's just so much. And I love imagining the kind of nostalgia that I have for rural Missouri, you know, the deciduous forests of Missouri or the rolling hills. I love thinking of my kids forming those core childhood memories around the beauty of Fort Collins.
Yeah.
There was one Thanksgiving or Christmas Eve or something like that we just took our kids to the square in Fort Collins.
Yeah.
It's actually just a block away from Fort Collins Rescue Mission. And with the Christmas lights, and it was freezing cold.
Yeah.
But my kids just ran around, you know, in this beautiful little town square. And so as a father, I'm super excited to be able to give my kids a really privileged experience of living in a beautiful city.
It really is a nice place.
Yeah.
And if you don't believe that, like, you probably haven't gotten out much. Like, have to do is go spend some time in other cities and you'll realize, oh, wait, this is a pretty incredible place to live.
Yeah, and it's intentional. I mean, I have spoken with Darren Atterbury, our former city manager, in my role and personally, because he went to church with me when I was a kid as well. And he's given me a lot of time that I'm super grateful for. And he talks about being a world-class community.
Right.
And that's, I think that's really evident in a lot of what we see in the beauty and the accommodations, the public accommodations of Fort Collins. And to connect that with my work, I am eager to inspire Fort Collins to be a world-class city, a world-class community when it comes to addressing the issues of homelessness.
Yeah.
And we are on the cusp of opening a new homeless resolution center in North Fort Collins that I really think is a flagship for that work. And it's not, I don't want to make this just about Fort Collins Rescue Mission and Harvest Farm or Denver Rescue Mission, because it was a community effort to get us to round out our capital campaign, to get, you know, the funding for this, or even just to set up the conversation around where to put a new homeless resolution center, because no one wants it in their part of town. Yeah. But the Fort Collins city staff and leadership really had the forethought to create a diverse group of citizens who rumbled through those topics and set us up to be able to take that content. It was a group called the Homelessness Advisory Committee. Yep. And they did a whole bunch of work over several years to really set up our work as providers really solidly. And so, being world-class community in regards to homelessness response means just having adequate shelter for people that need shelter, who don't have anywhere else to go. It's starting to get cold right now as we're recording this at the end of October. And the lives of a community are sacred, whether they're housed or whether they're unhoused. And the fact that people in such a beautiful city can be struggling with their life and limb on cold nights is just unacceptable.
Right.
And the solution is right on the cusp, but we're not quite there yet. We broke ground. It's about a year of construction, and so we're hoping to open right around this time next year.
Okay.
And we still have some really significant hurdles, some big barriers that are coming up this winter.
Yeah.
Before we have that long-term solution. Yeah. That's taken years to develop, but it's almost there.
Well, and I definitely want to take some time to talk about some of those hurdles, some of those kind of immediate needs. It's great to hear that maybe within 1 year's time,
yeah,
we'll be having a different conversation about how we can handle the winters.
Yep.
Let's talk about that in a moment, but I want to go back to a couple of things that you said. One, what an incredible phrase. I mean, like, if we're going to be a city of excellence and we're going to offer excellent services, we have to do that for everyone who calls this place home.
Yeah.
Every life is sacred.
That's right.
And, I mean, I just feel like that's worth repeating again and again and again, that every life is sacred. You know, as a pastor here in town, as someone who shares faith, you know, with so many others, that we're all created in the image of God, and we want to honor and create hospitable environments for everyone, even if they have different walks of life and backgrounds than us. And so that's really, really sweet to be a part of. You had mentioned about how this future space will, I don't know if this is exactly what you said, but almost will kind of serve as like a flagship opportunity or like a model of what could become.
Yeah.
So for those who are, you know, maybe they know a little bit about this, but they don't know the details of it, what are some of the distinctives or what are some of the differentiators that will make this space part of Fort Collins' offering of excellent services?
Yeah. Yep.
That would maybe be different than a shelter in another city?
Sure.
Or what would set you apart in this upcoming space?
That's a great question. The first thing is, you set me up perfectly, because the last word that you used to describe it is a shelter. And I'm careful not to describe it as a shelter.
Okay.
It's a homeless resolution center.
Yep.
It will have 250 shelter beds inside of it.
Okay.
But shelter comes with a lot of baggage when you're just throwing it out there. A lot of people assume things about shelter, that it's like three hots and a cot.
Yep.
That it's putting a Band-Aid on a problem, or that it's enabling bad behavior,
yeah,
or people to stay kind of in the churn of homelessness.
I would imagine those are like real things people have wondered,
right,
about. Yeah.
And I don't judge people or begrudge them for having those assumptions.
Yep.
Let's just work around it. And this isn't going to be a shelter. It's a homeless resolution center with 250 shelter beds inside of it. It was... designed by an architectural firm called Shopworks Architecture. And they specialize in a very niche type of architecture, and it's called trauma-informed design. And trauma-informed design means that before they started their design process, they came to our current facility and they interviewed people experiencing homelessness. They interviewed our staff. They went to another local homeless facility called Murphy Center, and they interviewed people who were experiencing homelessness there. They interviewed the Homeward Alliance staff. They just did tons of gathering of information from the people that will be utilizing this place. They've also done their homework. They've hired several people who've worked in the field of homelessness. They have a PhD level social worker who does research on trauma as part of their staff. And all of that informs the design of the building because the highest likelihood is that the people that will step foot in this building have had a traumatic event in their life. Right. They say, these might be a little bit outdated statistics, but you know, 84% of men who are homeless have had a traumatic event. 98% of women who are homeless have had a traumatic event. So you assume that the people coming into a homeless resolution center have had trauma. They designed this building to address all of the symptoms of PTSD, reduce the barriers that somebody with a traumatic history would have in entering a new, unfamiliar building, and had the layout to disarm comfort and make a welcome space for people with that experience. So one example is they've forgotten more about sound suppression devices and materials than I will ever know in my life. Yeah. Because sound is a really important thing. And if we're gonna have a lot of people in this building, having a lot of sound is something that will make it untenable for somebody who has trauma in their history to be in it. And so they've designed like a PA system with something called gray noise that dissipates sound, and all of these surfaces that absorb sound so that it's not a trauma trigger for them. And that's just one small detail of an example.
Well, when you stack multiple things like that and you do the work behind it, you create the hospitable environment. I mean, you know, when anxiety is running high internally or, or even externally around you, it's really hard to like care for other parts of your life and help people take a step forward, because the anxiety can, it has a way of crippling you, actually, you know, restricting you from being able to experience the healing and transformation that you need.
Or it's like blinders, you know, you have to look at what's right in front of you. You can't see anything on the periphery. You can't look around and engage with a part of your life. And the other important thing is we call it a homeless resolution center because the first step that somebody takes in this building, we are going to be talking about what it looks like for them to get into housing of their own. That's the purpose. It's not to keep them in their current state. We want to address those issues that need to be addressed in order for them to have an imagination of the future, like what you're talking about. You know, you have to address needs and then they can look at higher needs. But the purpose of the building is to give them access, comfort, belonging, and resources to get into housing of their own. And that's another unique thing about how we've designed it and how we plan to run it, is there's two ways of expanding shelter beds in a community. One is to build beds, and the other one is to make a stay in a bed as short as you possibly can. And that means getting people into housing as soon as you can once they enter into shelter. So those are our dual purposes, is we need to have life and limb safety, and we need to get people into their own places so that they aren't in that churn of homelessness and they're broken from the burden of homelessness.
I if you'll allow me to ask you a question that I'm sure it's not too sensitive for you, because I'm sure you hear all these kinds of different questions. A little throwback to my own history. I grew up in the state of Iowa, moved to Kansas City, and then moved here. But in Iowa, in a small town in Iowa, there is a baseball field that was built for this old movie. I don't know if you're going to remember the name of this movie or not, but it's called Field of Dreams. Yes, Kevin Costner, Field of Dreams. And the whole phrase in this movie over and over and over is, if you build it, they will come. Now, it's a Hollywood film, but I have to imagine in the space that you're in, doing fundraising that you're doing to try to build this world-class center, that someone has probably addressed the question or something, presented it to you like, yes, Seth, this is great, but isn't it true that if we build it, won't they come? And like, so like, one, is that true, or am I just making up a story in my own head? And two, if that is true, how do you navigate that conversation and help people understand the necessity for this, despite maybe their concerns?
I mean, it's not someone, it's every conversation I have. Okay. Honestly, it is. And again, just like people who have assumptions about homelessness, I don't begrudge them that, you know, if you're operating out of your own framework of life, and you just don't know what you don't know. And so I assume everyone has that question when they're seeing a new $27.5 million homeless resolution center. The answer that I have is two different answers, because painting with somewhat of a broad brush, there's two different kinds of populations when it comes to homelessness.
Okay.
There are those people who would choose to not be homeless. There is a small section of the entire population who are resigned to homelessness, who are, you know, a part of the criminal element that a lot of people assume goes throughout the entire population of homelessness, but it does not. It's a very short, it's a very small sliver of homelessness. And so separating out those two different populations, we are going to address those people who have found themselves homeless. They have very little hope that they can ever be anything but homeless, but there's a spark that they want to have something better for themselves. Yep. That's what this center is built for. And we have a good track record of how to move people from that state into having keys to their own place.
Yep.
For those that may be coming through our community or are in our community and they are involved in a lot of crime, you know, they are shown that they are resistant to the resources or shelter or whatever it is, we have strong partnerships with law enforcement, where we have really close friendships with the police in D1, with the HOPE team, with the Homelessness Outreach and Prevention, Preventative Engagement Team. And my answer is, if somebody is desperate for change and they stumble into Fort Collins and find this Homelessness Resolution Center and begin the process of getting into a place of their own and becoming a productive member of our society, where they can give back in some unique way, I say bring them in.
Yeah.
Because if we can reduce their shelter stay and get them into housing of their own, then we are just adding to the relational richness of our community. And we need people who have experience in homelessness to be in stability as a part of the rich tapestry of our community. And then for those that are not that, that may be involved in the negative interactions that people assume are across a spectrum of homelessness, you know, that's for our law enforcement to deal with. And we will partner with them all day long to be sure that that is being addressed both in our building and outside of our building. And we have a great police force. You interviewed Chief Sloboda.
Yeah, just happened.
They are fantastic, and they feel like they are very confident they can address that aspect of it.
Yeah.
So,
well, I think that's so great. I mean, I like just hearing your story, knowing my own story. I mean, I've struggled with addiction for a number of years in my early life and even when I was a teenager. And when you're addicted and you're a teenager, you make some really dumb decisions. I've looked back at my life and I realized pretty quickly I was one or two moments away from being exactly who you're talking about. Mm-hmm. One or two moments away, while I'm an addicted, enraged teenager, one or two decisions away from experiencing trauma and tragedy that would have spun me out in a totally different direction. And I think because I was so close to that on a knife's edge, maybe there's some inherent compassion within me because I'm like really just a couple clicks away. Sometimes we can insulate ourselves from believing that, but right. The truth is anyone that we encounter is really just a handful of moments away from needing your kind of expertise and care.
To go back to something we talked about before about relational abundance, yeah, carrying us through difficulty and suffering. People, I stole this from a lady named Ruby Payne who talked about this in education, but people are homeless not because of financial poverty. Yeah. They're homeless because of relational poverty.
I love Ruby Payne. I mean, you're dropping some real names here. Oh, Jared, yeah, Boyd, Ruby Payne, her book is on my shelf, Breaking, yeah, the Cycles of Generational Poverty.
That's right. That's
is
right.
An incredible manual, yep, for anyone who's working in this space.
And yeah. But it's the poverty of relationships that these people, through whatever circumstances, probably in part by their own hand, yep, have burnt bridges. So that when they are in those dire straits, they don't have anybody, yeah, else. And that's, yeah, why they are exiled to the streets, right, of our community.
They may be poor financially, but they're poor in a couple of different societal ways.
Yes.
That creates, they just have a different, you know, hand that's been, yeah, dealt to them all of a sudden.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and let me end with one story real quick. I knew a guy who was homeless. He was part of, he was a Native American who was taken away from his family in this kind of misguided reculturation. Mm. And he struggled with addiction for so long. And he went through Harvest Farm and was good for a while, but his path to wholeness wasn't straight. He fell into dire straits again. He was hit by a car in the Whole Foods parking lot because somebody mistook him for a bag of trash.
Wow.
That's how kind of degraded his life was. He got back into a good program again. Regained all of the things that he needed to. And the last time I saw him, I took a day off of work and I took the MAX bus to downtown for my daughter's birthday. And I run into a client and I'm like, ugh, my day off of work, no. Yeah. But he has grocery bags on his feet and he just got a haircut. And when he heard it was my daughter's birthday, he reached into his bag and he got out a roll of Sacagawea gold coins.
Wow.
And he dug his thumb in and he peeled off a coin to give to my daughter.
Yeah.
And people, even in the lowest parts of our society, could become somebody who can go around the community and give out gold coins.
Yep.
That is the hope that we have. That's the hope we should have for our community.
Yep.
And that's the hope that we have for this new building.
That is a sweet story. I mean, that your daughter could carry that memory with her
that's
for
right.
a long time.
That's right, yeah.
And it could, who knows where that story will take her.
And who knows what stories people experiencing homelessness on our streets right now can turn into,
right,
with adequate resources and, yep, accountability and relational abundance.
Well, may we all be part of that redemptive story.
Yeah.
Our city is filled with beautiful stories of redemption. You are helping write a ton more of them. This new center will write scores more.
Yeah.
Very briefly, I know we're running out of time, but I know there was a recent fire, mm-hmm, at the Denver Rescue Mission, and I know that there's some real struggles on how you're going to handle this upcoming season. And I imagine, Seth, that there's still, you said a $27.4 million price tag?
$27.5 is the whole price tag. We are $200,000 away from making that completely whole.
That's incredible.
We're at 27.3.
That means you have been a busy guy.
Yeah.
That means you have been a busy guy.
Last 2 years, yes, that's been a lot of my job.
So
yes.
Tell me how we can support you, how we can join you in this mission, how we can write redemptive stories alongside your work. Because I have to imagine many listening to this will want to support and come alongside of you. So just give me a couple of thoughts on how
so.
We can do that.
Because it does take this whole community to pull off something like this. So giving to our capital campaign, we would love to finish that last $200,000 up. FortCollinsRescueMission.org. It's called the More Than Campaign. Okay. This is going to be more than a shelter. Our unhoused neighbors are more than just homeless folks in our community. And we can do more than we ever thought or imagined with this campaign. So give to that. Our operational budget is going to be like at least double. And so we're going to need ongoing gifts. It's winter time, and yes, we're not in our original building, and we're looking for a place to expand shelter capacity for this winter and until we get into this new building. And that fire, we have like a $100,000 deductible for insurance. Yeah. And so if somebody wants to give specifically to the fire campaign also, that will help us secure a place where we can have we can kind of hold over until the new building gets built. Yeah. And give, you know? We're always needing coats. We're always needing gloves for this, for the winter season. We have a list on our website of other, you know, high needs for our guests. And be involved, be an advocate for the work that we do in addressing, you know, assumptions or stereotypes that people have, and advocate for us in our church, in your church or family or workplaces, and see what comes from that.
That's so good, Seth. And I know many listening, I think, will take you right up on those. We'll put all those links in our show notes. Maybe this time next year, we could have another conversation.
That'd be great.
On this podcast, and we could walk around and learn more and cast the vision for how other, you know, folks can continue to be involved. But I just want to say, I mean, man, from all of us at Love Foco, we are grateful you are in our city. And I know it's not a one-man show. I know it's not a Seth show.
Yeah,
there
for
are
sure.
so many yep. people involved in this. But thank you for loving our city one life at a time. Mm. Our city is better because you're in it. And we look forward to the way that we will be part of so many redemptive stories together. Thanks for your time, Jeff.
Yeah.
Thanks for all the work that you do.
You've been a great partner. Appreciate you.
Thanks for listening to the Love Foco Show. If today's conversation inspired you, share it with a friend who loves Fort Collins as much as you do. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. And leave us a review. It helps more people discover us. To learn more about Love Foco and find opportunities for loving our city one life at a time, visit lovefoco.com. For now, keep loving Fort Collins well.